Geek Radio Daily live at Mysticon 2019. Although this time it's just me, the wonderful Billy Flynn, who was once again honored to be able to host a Q&A for this year's guest of honor, Mr. Robert Picardo. Star of stage and screen, both big and small, an amazing vocal talent, as his Thursday Night Karaoke and Saturday Night Karaoke in the Egyptian Room showed, not to mention on the board of directors for the Planetary Society, planetary.org, check them out. Kick back, relax, and enjoy some time with Mr. Robert Picardo.
Ladies and gentlemen, approaching the stage now, a man of Broadway, TV, film, the star of Alice, Amazon Women on the Moon, and a man that would love to hear you hum the theme song to Benson. Please, Robert Picardo!
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Billy Flynn, right?
That's me.
You're a character in Chicago.
I am.
You? How about that?
All I care about is love.
That's great. And the great thing is you get a royalty every time that show plays anywhere in the world, right?
I do. And now, I still take the time out to come here.
And do you tap dance?
I do something that looks like it or having a seizure, but...
How did you feel about Richard Gere playing you in the movie?
I really thought that we didn't need the animal work, but overall I was impressed with it.
Very, thank you all.
I like the people that are informed. Thank you, you guys.
We have a Bolian in the back of the room, right? Are you a Bolian?
No,
an Andorian. I knew that. I'm sorry. I knew it.
He was testing you.
Is my mic on?
Hold on. Audio moment.
Sorry to interrupt. Is his mic working okay?
My mic is not working at all.
No.
You want me to go to the other side? Should I switch mics? Let's try this one.
It's just on.
Hello.
Oh. There's the mic now.
All right. There we go.
Hey. Hello. Hey. Hello, everybody. Nope. I'm Barry White.
Oh. We can't cross the streams. All right.
No. There's a speaker up there that causes audio interference with that one, which is...
Okay, so do I stay on this one?
Yes, by all means. Until he says no.
I'm sorry, I have a little... I am no longer contagious. I had a cold last week, but it's all settled into my chest. So I sound a little... But I
made the Barry White joke just because I sound a little like...
So,
lady,
I have to explain the whole Benson thing I just said. I know you have no recollection of this whatsoever.
All right.
But we met again. We met about 7 years ago in Denver, Colorado at Starfest. You and Ethan Phillips were there doing a wonderful little performance on stage.
Thank you. That doesn't sound like us at all.
And I was fortunate enough to get to interview not only you, but you and Ethan Phillips at the same time. And in a moment where I complimented Ethan Phillips on Benson, you said to me, "Posh, you've never even seen Benson." And I said, "Yes, I have." And you said, "Do the theme song."
All right.
And I started doing the theme song. Ba-da, ba-da, da. You're like, no. That's I Dream of Jeannie. And Ethan Phillips jumps and goes, no, they're similar. And we start doing the Benson theme song together. And you're just like bopping. It was a beautiful moment. And I know you've told everybody about that every day of your life since then.
That's absolutely not true. But the Benson, what is the Benson theme song? I don't remember.
It's just that. It's da-dun, 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 ba-dum-bum-bum, ba-da-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I know you're here for that. I'm so sorry. Sorry. But I had to relive that magical moment.
All right. And I'm going to tell an incredibly trivial, meaningless story.
Yes!
About Benson.
Your episode?
When I first came to... Well, I know I was in Benson as a guest star, but I find this more interesting. It's the very first regular television series role that I tested for. I did not get it. But I tested. They were adding two new characters, a press agent and a chief of staff for the governor. And I auditioned, and the roles were cast with Ethan Phillips and Renee Bourgeois, two actors you may have heard of. But the joke was that I was asked to audition for both roles, and I tested. I was asked to test for both parts because I was halfway between the sort of lovable, fussy, nervous character and the tall, arch, judgmental character. So I canceled myself out, as you often do when you're asked to try, because they couldn't decide which one I was. But isn't that kind of an odd coinky dink that we all went on to do Star Trek series? And of course, I opted for the arch judgmental side of the equation by playing the Doctor on Star Trek. However, I'm equally good at playing the officious boob, the Neelix character. So I have a broad range.
We just had a panel a moment ago that was it Virtual Realities, the mini roles, the mini lives of Robert Picardo, where we discussed your incredibly eclectic career and the fact that everybody here has childhood memories. There's things you love for your entire life that this man's been in that you may or may not know. And some of those we're going to cover. But first, I have to know, especially for your early career, have you actually participated in sexual perversity in Chicago, or did you just get that role for being a good actor?
I don't think I could answer that question.
Yes!
My first major role in New York was David Mamet's Sexual Perversity in Chicago. It was his first produced play. I mean, he's gone on to such enormous acclaim, one of the great American playwrights of our generation. I'm older than most of you folks, but my generation.
One of us.
And I was in his first New York production. And it was part of the reason I was in it was I was not a professional actor yet. Our stage union is called Actors Equity Association. I didn't join until February of 1976 when I was in an Israel Horowitz play with Diane Keaton. When Diane Keaton was 30 years old, that was my first professional job. But the year before that, when I was still training at Circle in the Square, having graduated Yale as a theater major, but I spent most of my time there as a biology major, so I didn't really have much experience in acting training. The Yale theater major at that time was primarily reading a lot of literature and studying the history of theater more than learning how to be an actor. I could tell you how many seats there were in the great Dionysian Theater before it burned down, and then how many seats there were in the new Dionysian Theater when it was rebuilt, which, of course, is really what an actor needs to give a good performance. So I studied at Circle in the Square, which is a professional theater workshop, not a master's program. I thought I'd made a deal with my mom when I graduated Yale that I would give it 5 years, and if I wasn't successful, I would go back and finish my pre-med education and become a doctor, rather than a television doctor. By my third year out of Yale, I was doing my second lead on Broadway. In fact, I was more successful at age 24, I think, than I've ever been since. I had a remarkably lucky career. I did two leads in two successive years on Broadway. But while I was training at Circle in the Square, a friend of mine from Yale was the casting director for an off-Broadway theater at a church in Midtown Manhattan called St. Clement's Church, where they had a very active theater program. David Mamet had agreed to produce his first play there, and they cast two actors that were in Actors Equity, that were professional actors, one of whom became a lifelong friend of mine, David Clennon, who played the part I eventually played, who went on to play the evil hologram, Kel Mozet, in the episode Nothing Human. So we were friends forever, and we worked together a number of times, and once on Star Trek. I know this is a very convoluted story, but those are the only kind of stories I tell. But in brief, the Actors Equity Association, the union, had a dispute with off-Broadway theater producers at the time over something called the Showcase Code. A showcase was a production where the actors were paid nothing, or next to nothing, maybe car fare, maybe $5 a performance, because it was a new play and they wanted to showcase the play in the hopes that investors would come along and the play would get a full professional production. So at the time, the dispute was over how many showcase performances of that play there could be. And the theater owners said, we can't even make our money back. We can't pay our rent and everything unless we have I think 24 performances, 4 weeks of performances, something like that. And Actors Equity said, no, 10 performances is enough or something. We don't want to take advantage of. So because there was this dispute, they canceled the production of Sexual Perversity in Chicago at the last minute after they were fully rehearsed with the two professional actors at that point. And since I was not in the union yet, I auditioned and I got the part. So I wasn't a union buster, folks. That was not it. They just decided to go with a non-union cast. And I got my first major role. I was reviewed in the New York Times. I was reviewed in New York Magazine. I got my first agent, all because of that play. But the fun part of the story is that my blessed Italian mother, Myra, came to see me in the play, sat in the front row, and every other word I spoke in that play was a four-letter word. I can't even tell you some of the lines. I mean, the C word, we all know what the C word is. We reserve that for special occasions. No, we don't say the word. But I had one line that says, "And your friend Joan, that was born in a car crash." That was the kind of line I had. And my mother sat in the front row. The audiences of young people is laughing. I had four scenes in bed in the play where we discussed, the woman I'm in bed with says, "Ask me if I like the taste of..." And I say, "Do you like the taste of?" And she goes, "Oh, do I like..." And I mean, this is my mother. And I'm 21 years old and I've just graduated Yale, right? She never laughed the whole show. Afterwards, I said to her, "So, Mom, what did you think?" And she said, "Well, I think you're improving." That was it. That was all she said. She had a very... So yes, that was the first time my mother saw me in New York. And then she came and saw all the plays where I was training at Circle in the Square. But that little production really launched my career. They remounted the play within a year, and they did not use either of the two men. They kept the two women, but didn't use me and the other guy. And I normally would have been heartbroken, except by that time, I was doing the lead in a play called Gemini, which started at a regional theater in Long Island, then it moved off-Broadway, and then it moved to Broadway and played for 4 years. It is something like the fourth longest-running non-musical in the history of Broadway. No one's ever heard of it, but I played the lead in that, and Danny Aiello played my father.
Oh, wow.
And if she hadn't left after the showcase, I was not in the showcase version of that, but if she hadn't left, I would have played opposite Sigourney Weaver as my girlfriend. Sadly, she took another show, and I played opposite another very fine actress who wasn't as famous as Sigourney Weaver. But the point is that was a very exciting time in my career, and I was very fortunate as a young actor in the theater in New York.
Well, you've got to do quite a few things, and so I wonder, with the insights and the people that you've met, did you ever get to share a cigar with George Burns in Oh God, You Devil?
I didn't share a cigar. I did work with George Burns. He was a phenomenon. At that time, I think he was in his late 80s, and the first time I met him on the set, it was a scene with, I think, five of us, George Burns, Ron Silver, myself, two other actors, Ted Wass and one other actor I can't remember. This is the first rehearsal of the scene. Normally, the actors have the pages, and they say, "Mr. Burns, this is Mr. Picardo. He's playing this part. This is Mr. Wass. He's playing this part," right? He came without the script. The director pointed to each of us and said who our characters were. And then the first time he did the scene, he was perfect. He looked around and looked at every... He's just met four people and been told what their characters are. No one, you know, even at that age, I would be like, "Oh, right, you're..." I'm sorry, that's you. You would never... But he did it seamlessly and perfectly the first time. And they led him like Stevie Wonder. They led him on... You know, this little old, you know, they walked him onto the set so he didn't trip. And then the moment he sat down, he was like brilliantly, you know, clear and sharp. So I didn't share a cigar with him because at that point I didn't smoke cigars. My cigar career began in the 90s, and this was in the early 80s. But I did ask him to sign a picture to me and ask him to write these words: "Dear Bob, wear the toupee. Love, George."
Well, you know, if we're going to talk about looks, someone brought this to my attention. I really do have to ask, exactly what kind of bronzer did they use on you in Starkiller for Explorers?
God, you know everything.
I do.
Explorers was shortly into my relationship with Joe Dante. I'd done The Howling for him. And then he asked me to be in the movie Explorers, which was Ethan Hawke's first movie. He was 14 years old. There were three young boys. They were all terrific actors. Sadly, one of them was River Phoenix, who died very tragically in his early 20s. And then another young actor named Jason Preston, also very talented. I don't know why he hasn't had a bigger career. Ethan Hawke went on, obviously, to become a highly regarded major star, who is absolutely brilliant in a movie this year called First Reformed, if you get a chance to see it. It's extraordinary. Anyway, I am cast in this movie because Rob Bottin said, he's a great actor, and you can do absolutely anything to him. Rob Bottin was the makeup artist who loaded me up with makeup in The Howling, and they knew they were going to create these makeup creatures that the actor would be buried alive, and you still had to come and perform through the makeup. So it's the only movie I play three characters in, Explorers. I play Captain Starkiller with my own face, but that's about it. I have Mantan on and a terrible wig. I look like Roger Stone, I guess, at 30. But I also play two makeup characters, one of whom is the lead. And the reason Joe wanted me to do it was because I had ad-libbed a lot on the set of The Howling making jokes, and he knew I was funny. And there was no final act to the movie, Joe said. The setup was great for this movie, but at the key point, for those of you who haven't seen it, and I don't expect a lot of you to have seen it, here's the gag is this. Three 14-year-old boys are all friends in a small town in America, and they start getting messages in their dreams, and they're all having similar dreams. And the messages teach them how to build a spaceship, basically, with things they find around the backyard. And they build this spaceship, and they have this new propulsion technology, all of which they get in their dreams. And it turns out they're being summoned into outer space by an alien who wants to meet them. And the reason the alien wants to meet them, you found out, is that he's a kid too. He's a teenage alien who's stolen his father's spacecraft and basically wants playmates, wants friends to meet in space. So I play this ridiculous alien named Whack, who looks like a cross between a refrigerator and a frog. I mean, I'm enormous. I have these tentacles. The makeup, I'm in the makeup with this enormous head and these, you know, mechanical eyes. I looked through the freckles in the character's cheeks were little holes. And that's how I could see. And I made up the part of because Joe Dante said to me, look, here's the idea that this alien has learned about Earth culture from watching television, capturing electromagnetic waves in space. He's watched TV and he's concluded what American culture is like from television. So the idea the writer had is that every time I opened my mouth, all I did was speak in original sound from classic television series. So I would open my mouth and I would say a line as Ricky Ricardo from I Love Lucy. Oh, no, honey, let's not have a scene, you know, like that. And everything was playback, meaning not my voice, but actual vintage recording that they cleaned up the sound and all that. And Joe said to me, this is an expensive movie. He says, that idea is going to work for about 30 seconds. And then after that, we got to do something else. But it wasn't on the page. It wasn't in the script. So he basically hired me to wear this enormous rubber costume and then make up everything I said, which I did. And I just made up things, literally, at commercials. I did a popular commercial at the time, you know, the American Express ad. Do you know me? Often when I go into a hotel or restaurant, people fail to recognize me. So I just did things that were on TV. Now, poor Ethan Hawke he's 14, he's never acted in a movie before, and he had all these scenes with me where they would turn the camera on, and he had no idea what I was going to say. Which is a terrible thing to do to a young actor. For example, late in the movie, he is trying to get me to go, once he realizes that I'm a kid alien, he wants to bring me to Earth to visit, you know, and see Earth and meet all of the... And I basically show him on my giant video screens scenes from Earth movies where the alien doesn't fare well. You know, the day the Earth stood still, right? All of these movies where the aliens are attacked by, you know, soldiers and gunned down and killed. And that's why I won't go, right? So once I've shown that, then there's no other dialogue. So I said to him, and this is the first time anyone hears these words, the director, the crew, the camera's running, and I say to him, I must look strange to you, but how do you think you guys look to me? I mean, I watched 4 whole episodes of Lassie before I figured out why the little hairy kid never spoke. I mean, he could roll over and play dead great, but I didn't think he deserved a series. Do you? And poor Ethan Hawke looks at me like this. No idea what to say, right? And then that cut, everybody laughs off camera quietly, and Joe Dante says, well, where did you get that? How did you even think that up? And I said, Joe, I sit in the makeup chair for 9 hours. I have time to, I could have made up War and Peace. So I basically ad-libbed that part. Or once in a while, Joe would give me a joke. He said, you know, here's some corny jokes. Here's one. And he goes, I got a new car. A Rolls Canardly. Rolls down one hill, Canardly get up the next. So I just did bad, stupid jokes, you know. Some of them politically incorrect, you know. How do you tell a deaf guy to tie his shoes? Tie your shoes! You know, just really one stupid joke after another, and then they just edited and picked whatever they wanted. So, but having talked for 20 minutes about this movie, Captain Starkiller was the hero of the movie within the movie. The kids, when they're testing their spacecraft, they fly by the drive-in theater, and the movie that's on the screen is supposed to be a cheesy ripoff of Star Trek called Captain Starkiller. So I had a blonde wig, and I don't remember much about it, except that we shot it in a Klingon torpedo bay from a set from Star Trek through the Search for Spock. So if you are ever asked the following trivia question, what Star Trek actor performed on a Star Trek set 15 years before he was ever in Star Trek, you know the answer.
It's a good one.
But also, because the set was really, it was my idea that they kept saying it's like a cheesy European movie trying to make a science fiction movie. So what I did is I did my lines on the set in Italian and then dubbed them into English without looking at the screen. So intentionally, the sync is off. I mean, I don't really speak Italian very well, but I did them in pidgin Italian. Cresta alla ora di distruzione. Now is it the time for destruction. But so if you look at my mouth, it does not work when it does not move at the same time as the words that come out. Just to make it look worse. So, and I got to kiss a very beautiful young woman who went on to have a love affair with Jack Nicholson, wrote an article in Playboy magazine, and then sadly died at a young age. So it was, it's funny. It's not funny at all, but in the distance of, in retrospect, every little job you have is a connection of different people, many of whom go on, like that one, Ethan Hawke, to tremendous stardom. I thought this kid will never act again. He's so traumatized from working with an actor who he has no idea what he's going to say. He'll probably never act again. So what do I know about young talent?
So, and I love that line. That line about, you know, of course I know how I look to you. How do you think you look to me? That blew my mind as a kid when I saw that. I was just like, well, duh, of course. The difference is just between regular people and of course a different species. That really opened up my line of thinking about not just looking at something and think I knew what the hell I was talking about.
And from my character's point of view, who looks so ridiculous, the difference between a small human, a human child, and a German Shepherd is not that much. The heads are roughly the same size. And they've each got 4 appendages. One of them seems to stand up better than the other. You know what I mean?
The smaller ones do 4 legs as well.
Exactly. So in other words, it made logical sense that this guy couldn't quite tell the difference between a human boy and a dog. But as I said, after 9 hours sitting alone with nothing to do, you think of a lot of things.
So do you often get mistaken for Martin Short?
No, we look nothing alike. Martin Short is talk about someone who is unspectacularly funny human being. I don't think he's ever really had the movie role that shows off his enormous talent. He can do absolutely anything. He's a wonderful dramatic actor, which you've seen him do sometimes on an arc on television, I think, where he played an attorney. He's just, he just makes me laugh. And nobody I'd rather see on a talk show, you know. I remember once he was on one of the evening talk shows, and he goes, he says, well, you know, he was doing a play in New York, and he says, well, you know, of course, Steve, or whoever he's talking to, my first love is the theater. And I suppose after that, movies and television, and then my family, you know. I don't know. He's hilariously funny. But I had never met him before that. And in the movie Interspace, I had to perform as him impersonating me. They didn't quite know how they were going to do the gag. And the original idea was that he would revoice all of my lines. When I'm playing his character with my face, that he was going to do all the lines. But then they ended up using my dialogue because it seemed to work better, and they just kind of changed the pitch of my voice a little bit electronically to be more in his range, which I was happy about because it didn't look as good when, you know, no matter how well you dub something, it never looks quite as good.
Yeah.
But in order to do those scenes, I asked if Martin Short would perform them they gave me a video recording of him doing the scenes, and I just copied his performance as much as I could. And about 10, 12 years later, when we did the Voyager episode, where the doctor is inside Seven of Nine, but not in a fun way, where she has to impersonate my performance, we did exactly the same thing at my suggestion. Robbie McNeil, our wonderful co-star, Tom Paris, who directed that, I said, when I did this exact joke in Interspace, I copied Martin's performance. So I said, let's shoot me doing all of her lines, and then Jerry can pick and choose what she wants to do. And I thought she did a spectacular job. Jerry Ryan got a call from the executive producer after they'd seen the dailies of her playing the doctor, saying, are you sure you want to look that unattractive? Isn't that funny? So I'm sure that's a backhanded insult to somebody, but I just thought she was so funny. And at my request, we also stole a gag from the movie. There's a moment in the scene where the doctor inside Seven's body is given his first taste. Now remember, the doctor has never eaten because he's a hologram, right? Or he's eaten holographic food. But he's never experienced the joy of real eating. But since he's in an organic human body, Seven of Nines, and he tastes his first bite of cheesecake, he shovels the cheesecake in, and then he asks the man who is flirting with him, because the man thinks that he's a woman, even though he's a man in a woman's body, he asks if that person wants a piece of cheesecake, and then he hands the half-eaten one and then takes a brand new one for himself. Do you remember that gag? There's a gag that I love in that, where Jerry, as I said, is shoveling cheesecake, says, would you like some? And then hands the half-eaten one and then takes a new slice and starts this. That's a direct ripoff of National Lampoon's Vacation, when Chevy Chase and his family goes to visit his brother-in-law, Randy Quaid. Randy Quaid is his sort of like piggy brother-in-law, and he's drinking a beer, and he goes, hey, would you like a cold one? And Chevy Chase says, sure, and he goes, and he hands him his beer and pops a new one for himself. That's my favorite moment in the movie. So you steal, guys. You steal from the greats.
And here's a good chance to steal. Any actors in the audience, please enlighten our actors. How exactly do you find the emotion needed to express the joy you did at the end of Gremlins 2?
That's a very sick ending. Joe Dante, because he knows me and trusts me and gives me a lot of freedom when I work on his movies, you know, we just did, I don't know how many takes, take after take, and we just did a different reaction every time. But when I did the one that's in the movie, he said, you expect me to print that? Meaning, because it was so kinky, because I do this look like, well, you know, what the hell? Again, it was just a joke, just to make the crew laugh, but that's the one that's in the movie. Ironically, I set myself up for any sequel, because any sequel would logically begin with a half-gremlin, half-human offspring, which would be my child. But there never was a Gremlins 3. But no, Joe just has a... First of all, he has a bit of a subversive sense of humor. And he just gives me a lot of freedom on inner space. There's a scene where the cowboy is getting ready to go out for a night on the town, and he's preening in front of the movie theater. In front of the hotel mirror. Do you remember that? He's singing "I'm an old cowhand" and all that. That's also completely made up. The script says the cowboy is getting ready to go out for the evening. That's all the script says, and that can be anything you want it to be, or that the director lets you make it, right? Now, when I auditioned for the cowboy, because Steven Spielberg was producing the movie, and Steven thought that the cowboy should be a scary villain, and Joe wanted the cowboy to be funny. So he said to me, okay, Steven thinks the character should be scary. Yeah, I don't want to do that. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to shoot an audition for Steven where you're scary, and then we'll just do whatever the hell we want. So I was doing a play in Northern California, super dramatic play in Northern California. I was doing the West Coast premiere of an AIDS drama called The Normal Heart, which they did on HBO with Mark Ruffalo. I don't know if any of you saw it. I played the Mark Ruffalo part, the lead character. Super intense, emotional bloodbath of a play. So that's what I'm doing. And I fly down... on my day off from Berkeley, California, down south to L.A., to blow up my shoes and do a clown performance of a character, you know, for Joe Dante. And I had, the cowboy is supposed to be of indeterminate origin. I think they said he was Albanian, which is Eastern European, right? I think I mistook that for North African. I don't know what I did. I just went in and I remember putting Vaseline in my whatever hair I had left, and I took a piece of candy, an almond roca wrapper, took the gold foil, and I gave myself a gold tooth. And then I sat in front of a video screen. There was no dialogue. The character had like two lines in the movie, or three lines. And I just improvised for Joe for a few minutes. And I used to live in a neighborhood in L.A. that had a lot of Israelis, so I basically did an Israeli accent because that was in my ear. And at the audition, I said something like, America is a great country. I love this country very much. He says, I like to sing for you now a collection of my favorite American songs. Okay. I got spurs that yingle, yingle, yingle. Happy trails to you until we meet again. I'm an alcohol hand from the Rio Grande. Yippee, ohay. I just made up songs and did in a funny voice. So I'm cast in the movie. and then they said, you have to do one of those songs, you have to just sing it while you're getting ready. So I did I sing I'm an old cow hand. I'm a cowboy who's never seen a cow. I don't love a steer because I don't know how. And I'm not for to start learning now. Yippee-yi-oh-hi. It's just stupid, right? So we go in that day and we know I'm going to sing. We don't know what I'm going to do. And he said, and this is how Joe Dante, now this is a multi-million-dollar movie with a star cast and all that. So the day we go to shoot the scene, Joe Dante in front of the whole crew goes, okay, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I'd like to do the macho version of I Enjoy Being a Girl. Does anybody remember that movie? It was the world of Susie Wong, where she, I'm strictly a female, and she's, you know, putting her stockings on and getting all gussied up to go out for the night. I said, I want to do like the sort of the male version of that. You know, I want to be every woman's nightmare of a guy that's going to sit next to her at a bar and not leave her alone. That's my goal. So, all right, what do you want to know? I said, well, I brought a bag of cowboy boots because the character had watched too many episodes of Dallas and thought he was a cowboy. So I said, if you start on a pile of boots and you see another boot hit the top of the pile and then kind of pan over and see that I'm trying on another pair, then I'll get up and I'll just sort of, you know, fix myself up, preen in front of them in the mirror. So that's, you know, so that's the way it was done. We just like, he says, okay, you know, dump the boots out. You come from me in front of the mirror. I pick up, I have like a shoe buffer to buff the tips of my boots off. And then I start pretending it's a gun and shooting. It's idiotic. And it's my favorite scene in the movie. But that's when you work with a director like that who trusts you and just goes, okay, you know, because I had worked with him at that point 3 or 4 times, maybe 5, on television and movies, and he had faith in my ability. But usually I would pitch him an idea in advance. This time it was like all just happened in real time. Just, you know, just try it. And that's why he's more fun to work with than any other director.
Good synergy. Good synergy. Now, for everything that you've done dramas, you've done comedies. If you ever get a chance, the vocal work, my God, this man is amazing. But for everything you've done, I think it's fair to say you're always going to be associated with the computerized character. So how did you make Johnny Cab so endearing?
Yes. One of my least favorite things is when a young person at a convention comes up to me and goes, oh, yeah, I know you. Yeah, yeah, my favorite one of your performances is Johnny Cab. And I go, that is not me. That is a plastic model of my head. Yeah, yeah, I love that. Thank you. it's hard. I had auditioned for Paul Verhoeven, who directed that movie, I think, for RoboCop, for the evil guy in that Kurtwood Smith, the wonderful actor Kurtwood Smith, ended up playing. So he'd already met me. Now, Rob Bottin, the makeup artist, the only reason I'm in Johnny Cab is Rob Bottin, who did The Howling, who did Explorers, who did Inner Space, who did the thing where my head turns into Martin Short's head, and Martin Short's head turns, and then back. He just likes working with me. And this was my swan song. I said, you know, after Explorers and in the giant alien costumes, especially the father's costume where I play the father alien, who had, instead of antenna, he had giant human arms coming out of his head that gesticulated wildly whenever he talked. Well, that was a 50-pound mechanical thing sitting on my head that had like an arm supporting it in the back. But when I, at the end of the day, I had open bleeding wounds in the top of my head from doing that. And I went, you know what? I don't think I could do this anymore. So my swan song was to get molded for Johnny Cab. That was the last thing I did for Rob. And he just said, it's a robot cab driver, and, you know, I just want you to be perky and happy. He said, I can't promise you you'll do the voice, but what we'll do is, once we've molded the character, then you'll go in and audition and for the voice. And Paul agreed to hire me when I did the voiceover audition. But I did want to do a joke, because it always struck me funny that Arnold Schwarzenegger had a heavy accent, a heavy Austrian accent in the movie that no one ever acknowledged in any of the movies he was in. No one ever said anything about it, you know. And also, cab drivers tend to have patter. They often chat up the person who gets in the car, hoping they'll get a better tip, I guess. So when he gets in the car and goes, drive, just drive. I said to Mr. Verhoeven, I said, what if I turn around to him and I say, hey, you talk kind of funny. Are you from out of town? And Paul Verhoeven said, no, we don't do that with Arnold. I said, just do it. What is it about? Just do it as a joke for the crew, so that, you know, because I'd be 2,000 miles away. They were down in Mexico. I said, why don't you just play? He says, no, we don't do that with Arnold. And they literally would not record the joke because Arnold apparently didn't have an accent.
Wow.
And he Hollywood magic. You know, you just didn't. I notice we have a screen here. We don't have a computer set up that we can play anything, right? I asked for a video screen and then forgot to give them the video.
No!
Which is really stupid. I do a monthly newsletter for the Planetary Society called The Planetary Post. And in one of them, I did an opera tribute to Cassini. I don't know if any of you saw it. To the end of the Cassini mission, the spectacularly successful 10-year NASA mission, the spacecraft that went to Saturn and took all those splendid photographs of Saturn and all of Saturn's moons, when in September of 2016, September of 2017, when Cassini sunsetted, it's when NASA, you know, that was the end of the mission. It went on longer than its original mission horizon. The plan was that the spacecraft would be given a command to basically take a dive towards Saturn's atmosphere, and it would break up so that the spacecraft would never pollute any other, you know, they would never, the artifacts of the spacecraft would never get in the way for future exploration. They decided to sort of vaporize it, going into giving it a command to dive into Saturn's atmosphere. So at that time, I did an opera tribute to the same tune of La Donna Mobile, which is the, you'll remember as Tuvok, I understand, you are a Vulcan man. That, and it is, I believe, my most viewed performance of my career. We did it in probably 6 or 8 minutes. I wrote the lyrics. The guy, my wonderful producer for the Planetary Post said, why don't we just, we'll make up a song. And I said, let's use a public domain melody and I'll just write some lyrics. So I wrote, goodbye Cassini, your mission's fini. Farewell Cassini, have some linguine. You showed us Saturn's rings and lots of pretty things. Titan's probe took a dive. I'm sorry. Huygens' probe took a dive early 2005, landed on Titan. It was exciting. Your mission never failed to surprise. Da da da, da da da, dazzled our eyes. Da da da. Now dive to Saturn, vaporize. All right, so I made it up in 5 minutes. We shot it, and I believe 8 million people.
Wow.
Now, but, and it was picked up, there was an article picked up the Associated Press, so there were articles about the Star Trek actor doing an opera tribute to Cassini in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, and newspapers all over the world on this little dopey thing we did in a couple minutes. Now, I don't understand what media impressions are, really, but that's when someone has heard about it. If they haven't seen the video, at least they read or heard about it. It got over 8 billion media impressions, which means I believe it is my most examined performance of my career. Had I known that, I would have spent more than 10 minutes.
Well, you know, as one of the on the board of directors for the Planetary Society, I love the fact that you're helping, you know, just bring science itself to people. How frustrating is it that we seem to have a current rejection of science going on in our country?
It is. It's sad. I was at the Science March in Washington, D.C. during the first year of the present administration, and there was a lot of, excitement and enthusiasm for science. You know, there's been a lot made. Whenever you hear about... I'm sorry, that's my ride. you have to remember that environmental protections were set up for us, for each and every one of us, protections, that everything has been renamed in politics. It's like, oh, restrictions on, you know, these onerous restrictions that are on corporations, that, you know, these corporations that are pissed off that they can't poison you guys, they can't ruin the water around there, and they can't do that. You know, all of that, all of the restrictions on what we can put up into the atmosphere or what we can put into our water table were designed to protect us, not to restrain industry, to protect you and your health. So when they become political footballs, when it becomes like, oh, this is anti-coal, well, what we should have done in this country was to see the writing on the wall and give everybody that worked in an industry that we were trying to transition from into from one kind of energy to renewable energy, what we should have done was realize that you don't just take those jobs away from people, you find a way early in the curve to re-educate and to give people new careers that are in, you know, forms of energy that are going to be in the interest of the stewardship of our planet. You don't just say, oh, you guys are out of work because now we're going to do this instead. So it was all handled and managed badly. But the intent to protect us and to protect our atmosphere was all for good reason. So now what we've done is the pendulum has swung the other way, and we've taken away all of these restrictions. We are now, in some ways, the pariah of the world because we backed out of the Paris Accords, and we are no longer responsibly being stewards of our atmosphere. You have to remember, our atmosphere bears the same relationship as the thickness of the skin of a grape to the grape. That's how thick your atmosphere is. That's what we're all breathing. And you can, and we are, anyone who believes, everyone now believes in global climate change, even climate change deniers. The denying has now moved over to, well, yes, the Earth is getting warmer and warmer. The oceans are rising. It's going to have catastrophic effects, but it isn't our fault. That's what the denial is now. It's not humans that are causing it. I find that untenable as a position. But even if you believe that, even if you think, okay, there's climate change, we're all in trouble, but it isn't our fault, we should still, even if you believe it's not our fault, everybody should be looking for ways to remedy that. So it is sad to me. If you're going to deny, and I also, I'm a person of faith. I am a practicing Catholic, but I don't believe the world is 6,000 years old. I don't think that our Creator wants us to, you know, we are endowed with this amazing brain and intelligence. I believe that it is possible to reconcile a scientific worldview with faith. I have no issue with believing in God and a benevolent creator, and also believing in, you know, the technology behind the cell phone that I use every day, and the fact that carbon dating tells us that the Earth is several billion years old, and that the universe is 13.8 billion years old. So I don't believe that, you know, I don't think you have to be a literal interpreter of the Bible to be a person of faith. So I think that we were, you know, I think that all of this can be reconciled. Our Pope Francis says there is no inconsistency between Catholic dogma and between the theory of evolution. So I am hoping that the pendulum will swing back, and that many of the protections for our environment will be restored in the future, and that we will be responsible stewards of the Garden of Eden that we we've been given.
It's kind of like that cartoon where the guy's going, "Well, if there's all these horrible things that's happening, why wouldn't you have sent us a sign, God?" And God goes, "I sent you scientists." So where are you going to be the rest of the day, sir?
Well, I will be signing autographs. They're all pictures of me, so don't get excited. Although Jerry Ryan is in some of them.
I was going to say.
I have pictures from everything in my career, right? Not only from Star Trek and Stargate, but I also have Howling pictures. I have Inner Space pictures. I have Wonder Years pictures. I've got more pictures than you would ever want. I even have pictures of me with glowing heads of hair from Gremlins 2 or from China Beach. For those of you who never saw China Beach, it's a Vietnam drama that I did in the late 80s and early 90s. It was my only leading man role on television. I auditioned for it balding, but back then you had to have hair in order to kiss a beautiful woman on American television. Thank God Patrick Stewart changed all that. So I did. It was a very serious drama, and I must tell you, if you're going to wear a toupee on a television drama, I recommend you don't do it in one with helicopters. There were moments when I thought $2,500 was going to be sucked up into the tail rotor. I got to work with the wonderful Dana Delaney. I'm now playing a recurring character on a show called The Code, which has not premiered yet on CBS. It's a military legal drama, and Dana is one of the stars. And I'm back in uniform in a show with Dana Delaney. We haven't had a scene together yet, but we had a nice reunion. We see each other otherwise about once a year for dinner, but I surprised her by showing up on her call sheet in her new show. So I hope you'll all have a look at that, The Code, on CBS. I think it premieres like in the next month.
Cool.
I think so.
Well, there it is. Well, make sure you get over, get yourself a fantastic autograph, get yourself a picture. Thank you so much, Mr. Robert Picardo.
Well done. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And there it is, a man with a wonderful sense of humor who can put up with me. Thank you so much to Robert Picardo for sharing some fascinating stories about your life. Make sure you check him out in every single thing that he does. And of course, stalk him on social media. He really wants that. And please go check out the Planetary Society at planetary.org. Thank you to Mysticon. Make sure you check them out, mysticon-va.org. An amazing convention, a hell of a fun time, and you should absolutely be there with us in 2020. Thank you all the staff, all the volunteers, all the people that work so hard to make that convention the amazing thing that it is. And thank you for checking this out, and there's more stuff coming right here from the fine folks at GeekRadioDaily.com.
It seems I found myself on a voyage of the damned. Doesn't anyone know how to turn off the program when they leave?